feel that overall and in general, and I don't want to force you to simplify, but I'll ask you to, that we're a culture in decline, and that you can trace that decline back from the Greeks, and that things that generally culturally have been on a downward trajectory.
Well, I think in some ways yes, and in some ways no. I mean, in some ways I think we have progressed as a civilization, you know, much further than the Greeks. And in other ways, I think culturally we have not, we have in some ways regressed. Mm. Now, with respect to our dramatic entertainment, I think in a lot of our popular films and entertainments that we have, in a sense regressed, you know, I would like to see much more, drama in the form of tragic drama than we do in melodrama. And I think melodrama is, at least in its extreme and crudest forms, it is a sign of decadence. It's like a confection, you know, it's like junk food. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to understand its attractions, and I find myself even getting drawn into them. You know, it's just like, you know, every now and then you grab a Snickers bar and you just eat it, you know, say the hell with it. It's mm-hmm. like there's something about it.
Yeah.
It's corrupting. It's and I that's just one avenue. But I think in our modern era we assign way too much guilt to technology. Technology is not evil. Technology is, I think, in many ways, just an extension of human nature and human potential. And to the extent that technology becomes something ugly and something unhealthy and decadent in our culture, or a contributor towards decadence, that's just a reflection of our own human nature coming out in the technology. Mm-hmm. And we need to address that. And that technology is going to force us to address it. You know, when we look at things like genetics and the power that we're gaining through, you know, understanding more about genetics and manipulating genes, and the extraordinary powers that will give us in terms of intervening in our own evolution, that's horribly scary stuff. I mean, we don't have, as a civilization, we do not have the knowledge and the wisdom to have that kind of power. Hmm. It's like putting an atomic bomb in the hands of a child. You know, it's just, it's terrifying. And our wisdom needs to catch up with our technology. Otherwise, I think it will destroy us. So that's a thumbnail sketch of... Yeah,
the history of human culture. Yeah, was sort of having an insight while you're talking. I mean, my view about your last point, more or less, is that human beings have always had this distortion in them, at least since the Garden of Eden, and that hasn't really changed. But what has changed is our power to enact it. Mm-hmm. And impose it on nature. So technology is just one of the ways, and mass media and all the rest of it. So that inherent or indwelling distortion, let's say, or that, I would say it relates to trauma, is Red Prisoner Infinity. So that's kind of a summary of my thesis there about the effects of trauma, and that distortion then becomes more and more magnified through our developing powers to actually express it and impose it on the world and reality. But it was, I mean, I've thought that for a while, but what was occurring to me while you were talking is that can also create a sort of negative feedback loop, because as human beings, any other, like other animals, although I think we are more than just animals, but we're embedded in an information system that is our environment, and we're constantly being cued by our environment, as in what's right and wrong behavior, really. And so the more powerful we are to create our own environment, the more we can actually feed the distortion, because we're actually projecting the distortion outward into these forms. So we're talking about genetic modification, that's a literalization of that, changing the human form. But even without that, just in terms of creating a technological environment, like being on the internet, social media, all the rest of it, I think it's constantly through this negative reinforcement loop, sort of positive in a way. It's a positive reinforcement of what I would say is an inherent distortion. It's becoming more and more apparent, more and more all-pervasive, and more potentially destructive. So bringing it back to Aristotle, what I was wondering for a while now is, you know, what would Aristotle think of the Godfather? Well, what would he think of the times that we're living in? You'd have to ask first, right? Or Shakespeare also, because that was still quite a few hundred years after Aristotle. So, you know, how much are these changing or mutating art forms or structures or whatever, how much are they a symptom of our apparent degeneration, and how much are they a response to it, which is potentially diagnosing it?
Well, great question. Yeah, and I think the answer that I would give to that is a very it doesn't really come from me. It comes from a guy, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, his name is Lipovetsky, and I'll have to send you the name of his book. It's one that eventually you might try to trace down and read. It's a very short book, but it's brilliant. And it talks about not postmodernism, but hypermodernism. And one of the ways in which he describes hypermodernism is that we have this bifurcation where we're going to two extremes. It's sort of like in Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, it's the best of times and that's the worst of times. I think we see that in our cinema, and I think perhaps Shakespeare and Aristotle might agree that there is much that is great and brilliant. I mean, sometimes I'll watch a television show or I'll see a movie, and I think to myself, God, that's just freaking insanely good. And other times I'll say, good Lord, this is so god-awful. How did it ever get made? You know, it's just... You've got, on the one hand, you walk into, you see these movies showing at the theater and they're so awful. And at the other hand, you'll see something come out and you'll say, good Lord, you know, how did that come out of all of this junk culture? And it's like we have these two extremes. And this guy, Lipovetsky, traces this out in, you know, all through not just movies, but through every aspect of our culture. And it's amazingly interesting how he does it. But that would be the answer that I would tend to lean towards, is that I think there is much to praise and much to condemn. And that is the uniqueness and the weirdness of our current situation. There's just a lot of both going on. You know, we see it in the presidency now, and it's like, just prior to that, when Obama was in office, not that I think Obama did everything right, but he was an admirable human being and a person with, you know, in many areas, a lot of integrity. And he is such a stark contrast in terms of his eloquence and his education compared to Trump. And you say, how is it possible for this country to elect two people like that, one after the other? It's just mind-numbing. So that's where we're at. It's very confusing, disorienting, and it's hard to know what to make of it.
Well, I have to say I don't agree about Obama, but then I'm a... well, you read Prisoner Infinity, so I have a very... paranoid view of what goes on the world stage. So But you could also say it's, sorry.
I can share some of that, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, you could also say it's a religio paranoid because I tend to see the office of president as the closest as there is to the office of Antichrist in our world. So at least I used to feel that way, and so that was my feeling about Obama, was that he was the charismatic face of, you know, the world dictator, and Trump is the, well, actually Trump's charismatic too, but let's say that Obama was the saintly face and Trump is the demonic face, but it's the same mask behind them. That's my feeling. I just have to throw that out there, otherwise my listeners will never forgive me for not challenging you on that.
I will agree there's something to be said for that. So, yeah, I don't want to defend Obama too much, especially where he was at the beginning of his term and how things ended up by the end. So it's yeah, it was very depressing.
Well, I mean, that's that could be part of the positive outcome, the sort of disillusionment. And when you were on a larger point that you were making there, what it reminded me of was something I just read in a book by Charles Upton, who's a very interesting sort of religious scholar. He was quoting another writer, and I won't be able to remember who it was, but I think it was a Sufi writer, or maybe just an Orthodox Islam writer. Anyway, he was saying that because, you know, Islam and Christians, they both believe that we're living in the end times, and of course, living in the end times is, you know, it's a really hard time to be alive. But he was saying it's also the greatest time to be alive because those who live in the end times have an opportunity to see Satan face to face. They actually have, get to see, you know, the adversary, and therefore identify, you know, absolutely the nature of the problem, so to speak. I'm now completely paraphrasing, but I mean, take that symbolically, take it literally, or a bit of both, as I do. But speaking to this question of what you were pointing out, which is that things overall tend to seem to be getting worse and worse, but within that, there does seem to be the possibility for moments of clarity to emerge from that. And I would say that's why, because the more we can actually see the nature of our distortion written large on the movie screen and the stage of the world, the more we can identify it within ourselves and have that moment of insight that really counts, I think. And so, I mean, maybe, yeah, maybe there's a process there that, because I still watch TV shows, and I enjoy them. I kind of cut down recently for Lent, but anyway, I'll be getting back to them soon. But I'd say they're less and less central to my sort of developmental process, and that maybe that's just me, or maybe it's that we're sort of getting pushed further and further into this tight corner where the only way to look, where we will see a way through, is that inward glance, as you put it.
And so so you're saying that you do put some hope and some faith in that inward glance and its potential.
Absolutely. I mean,
Yeah, I can agree with that. But now does that in a way, would that mesh with let's say the old Socratic thing that the unexamined life isn't worth living kind of thing? Is it when people start looking inwardly and examining not only their life but life in general and reflecting on it a little bit, is that where you think the shift can take place toward a more productive way of living? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Except for the last bit, because I mean, I think that the living more productively, oh, that brings up specters of capitalism for me. But, you know, living a more fruitful life, I presume you mean, is a more healthy, fruitful life. I think it absolutely is going to be the result of that inward orientation. but I don't think it's the goal of it. Let me say to qualify there that, yeah, I'm very pessimistic about the world, but that's the nature of my optimism in that. It's kind of like that quote I said. I've always seen the world as a kind of an adversarial presence, that is there essentially to mirror, as a mirror for me to identify my own corruption or something like that. But I've been in this interesting, strange time in the last few years because I've become more and more integrated into my community, running a thrift store, and so my local world is becoming more and more seemingly benign, and I'm becoming more and more of a benign presence within it, less and less adversarial anyway, let's say. And I do see that as both a result of and as contributing to becoming more inner oriented. And when I say inner, I don't necessarily mean navel gazing, but I think it is self-examination. I mean, Socrates was he was a religious man, yeah. So when he said self-examination, he was presumably looking for God. I mean, I'm just that's a question really, because I've only read very little Socrates. But would that be fair to say, do you think?
Well, I think so. I think that would be maybe for some people, it might be a little bit of a twist they might hesitate on. But I think that's certainly one way of putting it. And of course, we would have to say, well, in that case, the term God probably has a very expansive meaning. But yeah, I can see that. And I think I have to say that one of the things that, I really thought remarkable when I've been reading your books like Seen and Not Seen, and the more recent one you sent me, the title of which the
Prisoner of Infinity.
Prisoner of Infinity. Yes, how could I forget that title? I just saw in there so much amazing introspection and. At the same time, you have a very, it strikes me as a very accurate way of seeing what's going on around you and describing it and the events and the experiences. But then, and being very genuine about that, and then going in and being very genuine about how you're reacting to and how you have reacted to these things and what you've done. In terms of your own self-examination and growth, modeling that in such an amazing way in your text and in such an articulate way that for me it was just kind of jaw-dropping to see that going on because for me you were modeling something that I feel so much needs to be modeled, especially in the area of the topics that you were confronting in Prisoner of Infinity. These are topics that are difficult and challenging for people to sort out. And yet you have rushed right in there and have done some very deep thinking about them. And I think showing people a way in which they can be skeptical without being necessarily so academic that you're just dismissing these things as nothing altogether. You are giving them their due, and yet at the same time giving them the critical reflection that they deserve. And I can't say enough for that. I think it's just it's great, and that book was so needed. I just hope that it really takes off and a lot of people read it.
Well, thanks. That was wonderful to listen to. Difficult to respond to, of course, because but it's much appreciated. And I think, I mean, one thing I would zero in on what you said is that the process you described of observing what's going on around me or what's happening to me, including or even my own behavior, and then but then also observing my reactions to that's quite a concise summation of a sort of transformation that's happened in my writing process is to try and reduce it to that, to boil it down to that as a means to being, to be, for being as honest as I can in writing, in representing my experience. And so it's sort of a, I guess it's a self-reinforcing process, and maybe this is relate to what Socrates calls self-examination, but my attempt to testify to my experience as honestly as possible makes it necessary for me to be as honest as I can with myself. And so then there's this process happening by the act of writing, and then the book becomes actually a testimony to that, you know, to what I had to submit to in a certain sense. So, and you mentioned rushing in. Well, that was the point with Strieber, is I did rush in, you know, decades ago, where Angels Fear to Tread, and into this whole Weltanschauung, you know, of alien abduction, and also Seen Not Seen. I rushed into Clint Eastwood movies desperately, you know, like a drowning man, really, wasn't it? And took refuge therein, and became a prisoner, not of infinity, fortunately, but of culture, sort of hostage to my culture. And so, yeah, this is my, the means of extricating myself. To a certain degree, I assume a skeptical position, which isn't necessarily, it's not that I'm pretending, but I'm trying it on, so or trying it out, I should say. So with Prisoner Infinity, and I wonder if this relates to postmodernism, I don't know, because I do want to get to that before we finish, because I know you've written a lot about it, but that I thought, well, let's approach Strieber's tales as if they were all, you know, the result of psychological fragmentation and sort of waking hallucinations and so on. I mean, I don't quite narrow it down that much, but pretty much it's kind of like, can this be, can I maybe explain all of my experiences this way, to see what's left at the end of that? And there was something left, just as there was something left with Clint Eastwood and Pauline Kael and so on. But it's kind of like the elixir residue, I think. It's just kind of like boiling down to the essence, because so much of our experience, and I will try and bring it to postmodernism now, is interpretation. And then we mistake the interpretation for the thing, and we go away with the interpretation, and we build a whole house and a lifestyle around our interpretation, but it isn't actually the phenomena itself that we interacted with. So then we need to go back to the phenomenon and meet it all over again. But to do that, we have to let go of the interpretation. So there's a sort of a dual process there of re-engaging with the past, I suppose, is what I'm talking about. The past that haunts us.
My leave if you don't want me. I'll close the door and walk away. I'll take my jersey and my raincoat and meet old Murphy at the gate, and I'll ride through the night with your picture in my pocket and jug of Irish whiskey at my side. With the sky dark and gray, I'll roll out on the falling tide. Nothing more that I can say. my side. And I'll wake in the morning just to catch you on the rising tide. Take my leave if you don't want me. I'll close the door and walk away.
Yeah, when I was reading your book, there was a period that I went through in the 1980s and a little bit in the beginning of the 90s where I was really exploring a lot of these esoteric phenomena. And I had a huge amount of curiosity about them. And I was like you were saying in terms of trying on a skepticism. I was trying on belief. I was trying on, you know, well, what if this is true? What if this, you know, what, like I wasn't jumping in wholesale, but I was just kind of sticking my foot in, you know, and testing the waters and seeing what it felt like and looking at the world from different perspectives and saying, well, okay, why do we have to rule things out before we really know what we're talking about here? And So I ventured in and explored and I found it all very fascinating. I didn't probably get hooked in, at least if I understand it rightly, in quite the way that you did. In some ways, I remained, and probably that's really a core of my being, is to be a skeptic about virtually everything. But I'm not a negative skeptic, you know. I'm like an easier skeptic in terms of saying, well, okay, I want to put things on and try them a while before I get to the point where I want to, you know, criticize the hell out of them. So I really appreciated the way that you went through your approach in that book, because it seemed to me that you struck such an interesting balance between giving these phenomena their due and yet maintaining the ability to think of alternative explanations for them and to entertain those from a point of view of some integrity, where you're you're not just jumping in and saying, oh, you know, I'm a wholesale believer, or jumping out and dismissing them as errant nonsense. You're finding that perspective, which I think is, you know, I like to think of that, and this term might turn you off, but I like to think of that as a scientific approach. Sure. Where you open up to something and you let it in and you try to sort it out as best you can. And if you do not have the evidence to totally rule it out or do something with it, then you leave it as a question mark. And you come back to it again later, maybe. But you maintain a kind of openness along with your skepticism. And I don't know if you feel I'm characterizing you correctly there, but it just seems to me that's the balance you were finding. And I think it's a balance that is so much needed when looking at these phenomena. And I think it can be appreciated from both sides, of the, you know, the side of the true believer and the side of the total skeptic. And at least I hope it would be.
I would hope so too. I think it's much less likely to be appreciated by the believers. I think essentially, having had my experience with that demographic, I think that they're pretty much unreachable. I mean, not all of them, obviously, but the more entrenched in belief. But I guess that's true of the skeptics too. I mean, I don't suppose Richard Dawkins would be too interested in my book, you know? So. But regarding the scientific comparison, I don't mind that at all, although I think more accurate would probably be a mad scientist, insofar as I'm the kind of scientist who injects himself with the killer virus to see what it will do. He's got the machete on hand in case he has to chop his arm off.
Yeah. Okay. Good analogy. Well, it was just Yeah, it was just well written, and it was just such an adventure to going through it and reading it. And I hope it does well.
Well, thanks. Wait till you see the one that follows this one.
You have a sequel going?
Yeah, it's a trilogy. I've decided to call it a trilogy anyway. Seen or Not Seen, Prison Infinity, and then the Vice of Kings is coming out later this year. I'm just finishing it up, and that's about organized child sexual abuse and Fabian social engineering. It's a real horror story.
Wow.
Not that Prisoner Infinity isn't, but it seems like I just go deeper and deeper. I don't know. I mean, so far, but maybe I'm going to... It's back to this, the tragic trajectory. There's the title. And I do want to get back to that, because I think it's a very compelling idea that if we go deep enough into the darkness... we do find that we come out the other side, right? Taking that on faith entirely, really. But there's something interesting about faith, because I think I used to think that faith was just believing things that you didn't know, but now I think of faith as believing something that you do know, but that your mind can't actually formulate. Or comprehend. But anyway, that's a side thing. But as far as coming out the other side, and I mean, I'll bring this because I'd like to bring it full circle, and I'd also like to include moralism, but moralism and postmodernism. And in relation to what I was just saying, that it seems as though, I mean, where we are collectively in the Western world, and I think we can lay a lot of this at the feet of postmodernism, is in absolute relativism, where nothing is really real unless, you know, I mean, everyone has their own reality, and everyone has their own morality, and everyone has their own interpretation, and there's no absolute truth, and there's no absolute reality, and there's no absolute right and wrong. I don't believe that myself. I think it's necessary to go into that sort of liminal state where you let go of preconditioned ideas, but I don't think there's any point in doing that if it's not in order to find the real ground. And my sense of you is also that, because you're somebody who's studied a lot of postmodernism, but you're also somebody who's presenting a moral framework for movies, so it seems as though you must have a sense of some real ground there in existence that generally isn't allowed for in postmodernism.
Okay, and you want me to respond a little to that?
Yeah, if you could.
Yeah, well, that is something that I have thought a lot about, and I think to begin, there is a bit of a mistaken assumption about postmodernism in that regard. Maybe not entirely, but I view postmodernism as in its best version as Derrida's work. The other postmodernists who go along with him, are classified along with him, like Foucault and Lacan and many others, I think they're in a bit of a different category. I don't respond to their work quite as much. I put Deleuze a little closer to Derrida. But I think Derrida is, for me, the paradigm example of postmodernism, although I met Derrida twice, two times, and had interesting long talks with him, and discovered that he doesn't like the word postmodernism and doesn't want to be put in that category.
Is he still alive?
No, actually he died in 2004, unfortunately, of pancreatic cancer. But he is my model, and so when I talk about postmodernism, and especially the issue of let's say ethics or morality and the issue of relativism, I think of Derrida and his response to it. And he said, you know, that as far as philosophically rigorous relativism, his philosophy has nothing to do with that. I think of him as, and I categorize it as more like contextualism, which is different than relativism, in the sense that our meaning and our judgments and our significance for everything derives from context in which we view them. And context is not something that we entirely construct, nor is it something that we entirely find. It's a blend, and we bring our past experience, our memories and everything to every material external context that we confront. And what is derived from that in terms of what we call our experience is a blend. And so it's a context, and in that context is of how meaning arises. And so relativism, from an ethical point of view, where the idea that one point of view is as good as another or one interpretation is as good as another, that kind of radical relativism is not at all what contextualism is about. Contextualism is simply the idea of saying, well, okay, what context are we operating from here? And as a collective, that can at times be difficult to sort out when you have two people or a group of people or a community of people. You can't just take it for granted that they're all operating from the same context, even though they might be in the same community and they don't operate from a consensus, even though they might all vote for the same person. They might all do it for different reasons. And so it's complicated, but it's not like relativism in the sense that there is there are no criteria for evaluating from a collective point of view what might be the better interpretation or what might be the better law or right or moral to adopt. So, but the minute you have introduced context as an element, then you have complicated the picture considerably. You can't readily draw black and white lines, and you have to. Derrida always believed you have to. There's no alternative but negotiation
and dialogue.
Dialogue, I mean, I suppose you could call warfare a form of negotiation.
Isn't that when the negotiation has broken down?
Yeah, he would think of negotiation as talk, as politics, as, you know, definitely you can't eliminate the power struggle involved in it. But ideally, it's something that human beings have to work out. And frankly, I believe that we have progressed, you know, to the point where we are more inclined to use words rather than swords. But we stand ever on the brink of catastrophe with the fact that we have such an increasing technological power at our fingertips. So I think the importance of working things out through words becomes really crucial.
Well, that's interesting in relation to compelled speech laws and hate crimes and the way in which language, political correctness, the way in which language itself is becoming regulated by power, let's say, by law even, so that it's becoming harder and harder to actually have a real dialogue. Like I made the joke about biological sex, as I trusted I was in, you know, safe company for that. I wouldn't make that joke with certain other people because they wouldn't find it funny, and it might lead to a discussion that wouldn't be a conversation, wouldn't be a dialogue. It would simply be, you know, irreconcilable difference of perspective. And I do think that the language is is kind of the first casualty of that ideological polarization thing. And that's another truck I have with postmodernism, is it seems to be traceable. You know, identity politics, and your point of view is as real as anyone else's, so if you want to say what sex you are, we have to go along with that, even if you're only 5 years old, you know, but just to bring it to actual real life circumstances now, that I think that has its roots in postmodernism, not only, but I mean, that there is you can trace a correlation there, no?
Yeah, I do think there are some postmodern theorists who deserve the criticism in that regard. Baudrillard might be one in particular who stands out. That process of what was I trying to say? In terms of what Derrida was trying to do with his project, was to, you know, point out that the language is very important, and in fact, that's why, like you bring it up, I agree with you in the importance of that, and the way it has been twisted and turned recently is troublesome, and Derrida didn't like certain directions that was going either in terms of political correctness and even certain versions of feminism he was very critical of, and even feminists who cited him as a source for their thinking on feminism he disagreed with. Right. Said, oh, they're misusing me. And it wasn't that he was opposed to women gaining more prestige and power in the political system. He just felt that the basis on which they were theorizing it was counterproductive to their goals. And so, but I agree on the importance of language. In fact, I think that understanding how language works is critical to human relations and to the future that we would have in terms of the possibilities for negotiation and negotiating our conflicts. We have to understand better how language works, and which is basically to understand that language has limits to what it can do for us. And we discover that very quickly when you try to write a law about something.
Right.
You try to frame it in words that will not get misinterpreted or misunderstood or find loopholes in, and it's very difficult to do. So I'm writing a book right now. In fact, the project I'm working on is a comparison of Wittgenstein and Derrida to the two, what I would regard as the two greatest language philosophers of the 20th century. And I'm comparing them and contrasting them and showing what I think the important differences are. And ultimately, I come out on the side of a preference for Derrida, and I think he has a little better edge on it. But I think they're both very interesting, and I think they both point out important limits to language, which will give us pause in terms of being so ready to categorize and label things and people, among many other things. I think it's like what you're mentioning, the polarization in the dialogue and in the factions in this country is yet another symptom of what this guy Lipovitsky was talking about, the hypermodernism of the extremes, where you get these factions, but you get very depressing things happening, but you also get flashes of brilliance where you look and you see somebody who's doing something that you think is incredibly right. And it gives you pause, it gives you hope, and then you turn around the next day and you see something that makes you want to lose your hope. So
sometimes coming from the same person.
yeah, that can be even really disturbing. Comes from the same person, you think, my God, you know, what's happening to my judgment? I would say that postmodernism deserves a fair amount of the indictment that they have gotten, but I would also want to, and in the book I'm writing, I'm trying to exclude Derrida from a lot of that criticism and point out why he is an exception and why his ideas are more complex and more interesting than that, and why it deserves a second look. So I share some of your concerns about postmodernism, but I would like, and I don't know that, you know, it's something that we could do right now, I would like to persuade you that postmodernism, as Derrida practices it, even though he didn't like the word, is something that you should consider as being worthwhile.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'm exactly easily persuaded, because I wouldn't say that I'm just going to believe you because you said it, but I definitely had that sense already. I mean, I feel like I've seen enough how good insights, how quickly they can degenerate into really dodgy ideologies. Like, I mean, we just have to look at religion for that. I mean, the gospel is still a great book, and the insights in there are as sound as they ever were, but it doesn't mean I want to join my local church and hang out with Christians. I don't, you know. So it's endemic to our culture, and I think it's accelerating as well. So it's not hard for me to believe that Derrida might have actually had some brilliant insights, and now he needs rescuing from his own legacy, so to speak. Whether he needs it or not, but I mean, in terms of separating the wheat from the chaff, that's certainly what I'm very engaged in. And sometimes it isn't with a single individual. Like all the individuals I've looked at, they're good and bad, really. And actually, I mean, probably more bad than good. Actually, lately, anyway, I seem to be. There wasn't much to rescue from Strieber's opus. There wasn't much from Crowley's in my last book. Anyway, I'm looking at Jordan Peterson right now, who's something of a phenomenon, and not sure there. It seems a bit closer to 50-50 in his case. But I just think it's a very valuable, worthwhile process in itself, like learning to discern good insights from bad, not just by looking at oneself, because one can't always tell. Like, one is looking at one's own insights with the same sort of tool set that one had the insight in the first place, so one of course is going to be attached to them, whereas if one looks at others, it can be easier to discern, I think, and then one can then apply that to oneself. So I think it's worthwhile in and of itself, whether or not you're restoring a tradition to its former glory, or whether that's needed or not. I have a question about your book, about language. Do you talk about the difference between spoken and written language?
Kind of indirectly, because that's a theme that comes up in Derrida's Of Grammatology. So what I have done, there's ways in which Derrida has been roundly criticized for this distinction, and some for the distinction, or I should say the non-distinction he makes between speech and writing, in his attempt to kind of show that speech is a form of writing, what he calls archy writing. But and I deal with it in the sense that I address the criticisms, what the critics have said about his distinction and Of Grammatology and what he's attempting to say there. And I attempt to defend what Derrida has said and show how the critics have really misunderstood the distinction he's drawing in terms of showing the similarity between the two. Mm-hmm. And certainly, in doing that, Derrida isn't trying to suggest that there aren't any dissimilarities that can be drawn between the two. I mean, it's obvious that there are important differences, but
he's making a spectrum then.
Yeah, he wanted to point out a sense in which there is an important similarity between them. And that comes under the rubric of his term text. Both speech and writing are forms of text, and every textual artifact is a set of signs, and those signs require reading. And
right.
Just as we're having conversation here orally, we still have to read or hear or understand what the other person is saying, and that reading involves sign operations and being able to work with signs in ways that are similar to writing, to a text as writing. So what he's saying is that it raises similar issues of the problematics of interpretation that we don't escape whether we're dealing with speech or writing.
Right. That makes sense. I mean, it's decoding, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I touched on in Seen and Not Seen, and I didn't actually refer to mirror neurons and stuff, but this notion, I think it's more than a notion, that when we communicate well, certainly when we communicate by speech, even now over Skype, it's a lot more than just the words. Mm-hmm. So you've got the tone of voice and the feeling content, the affect.
Mm-hmm.
All of that's communicating too, and that would even go more directly from body to body. And I think biologists or anthropologists have said this, whether they're correct or not, but it makes sense to me that the decoding of the language, it takes longer than the actual body-to-body communication, particularly if you're in the same space and you've got body language. But in Seen and Not Seen, I suggest that maybe I only touch on it. I wrote a piece about it also, about mirror neurons. But I touched on the possibility that writing might also contain a sort of unconscious content by which the text itself transmits the context in which it was written. So whatever I was feeling, if I had indigestion at the time I was typing, you know, if I was not quite focused, if I was focused, I use the example of Dostoevsky, like this fevered writer, he was so utterly immersed in his writing. Of course that transmits to the reader. His novels are as immersive, I would say. They're immersive in proportion to how immersed Dostoevsky was in the act of writing. And so that's more than just the words then. The words are like carriers of this sort of these zip files of information. Yeah?
Yeah, good term. Yeah. I agree totally with that. I think Derrida would agree with that too. It's like there's so much that comes along with words that and it is a little different in terms of what comes at us from a written text and what we get out of, like you're saying, face-to-face conversation, tones of voice, gestures, all kinds of things. It's rich, it's layered, and it's got layers and layers of context. You know, two people could be having a conversation in a room, and maybe that room is a jail, or maybe that room is a theater, or maybe it's something else, and the context matters to the substance of what's being said in certain ways. If you realize what the context is, and then you can go out beyond that and say, well, what town was it in, or what country was it in, and that throws a whole new angle of interpretation on it.
What was the weather like?
Maybe it was just after a nuclear bomb exploded down the road or something. You know, all kinds of things could affect the context of how it's to be seen, and it just depends on that. And it's so it's rich and it's layered in lots of different ways, and that is part of what Derrida sees as the problematics of interpretation, is the unbounded nature of context and the fact that we have to artificially put a boundary around it in order to begin making sense out of what's being said.
Right.
And in a way, we have to do that. We are compelled to put up this artificial boundary, because if we don't, we can't really make any sense out of it.
Yeah, so that's because context is potentially infinite. Like, you can always expand further out, and language is by definition finite. So it's like, language is of necessity, in order to work, language has to impose a somewhat arbitrary order on our experience and our expression.
Yeah, and there's the context that goes outward and the context that goes inward in terms of your own past experience, your memories, your predispositions, your whatever, you know. There's a huge element of context there that you bring everywhere with you, and each person does that. And so, there's so many layers to it that in so many directions that this is what Derrida focuses on as one of the reasons why interpretation is so difficult, and brought him into confrontation with a lot of other theorists who didn't want to place that kind of emphasis on context.
Well, it's that good and evil. I was thinking about how language allows for totalitarian thinking. I mean, you could say any kind of thinking is language-based, but it's not necessarily true because some people think in images. The yin-yang image represents a duality, but it's a very different representation to the verbal construct of good and evil. And the verbal construct of good and evil essentially separates. I mean, words separate everything because they are separate. Words are separate. And also it's possible to separate them out. So it's like that whole thing of what Derrida was complaining about getting quoted out of context and misapplied. That's if you want to misapply somebody's words, you take them out of their context and put them into your context, and you can do it. And you maybe do it consciously or unconsciously. So it seems as though that is something that can snowball. And I'm sure Derrida must have written about this, that like the more immersed we are in a text-based kind of world, the more that influences our thinking, the more we start to think in a, you know, as if we were writing, and the more we speak, you know, the more that writing and text informs our way of speaking, which would be kind of reversing it, because initially it started with speaking, and then we developed writing, but after centuries of writing and printing, and now we've got the internet and tweeting, Facebook, and we're just so immersed in text, maybe that can, you can trace that as one of the root causes for this increased polarization, because language itself polarizes.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. And one of the ways in which what you were just saying there was recently impressed again on me was I went to a talk and I heard this guy giving a talk about Hegel, and talking about Hegel's views on the French Revolution and the idea that so much violence resulted out of the French Revolution. And Hegel was trying to understand that, and because supposedly this was an attempt to bring some sanity into the world of politics, and it results in a bunch of guillotining of heads.
Right.
So
that's polarization.
Yeah, and he came up with this idea that I thought was brilliant in terms of just the idea that the whole, what was it, liberty, equality, fraternity were the three important words of the French Revolution credo. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, each one of those is an ideal, and as a word, we attach, you know, all the significance to them, and yet in the process of doing that, in the process of having faith and belief in the power of those words, we idealize them to the point where we want to move in the direction of complete purification. So we want complete equality. We want complete liberty. We want complete fraternity. And so then they begin looking around and saying things like, well, so-and-so here doesn't look like looks like they're contaminated, you know, looks like they're not upholding the equality the way they should. And so off with his head. All of a sudden, the ideals became so purified and the enforcement of them so extreme that, of course, nobody could measure up to them. And so everybody started falling left and right. And this is what happens with words. You know, we take a word like justice and we purify it to the point where justice becomes the opposite of what it is. It becomes like a terrorism. You know? Well, that's exactly what's happened in the Middle East. You know, these
Tolerance becoming intolerance as well.
Yeah, the idealization of these notions is one of the ways in which language, I think, really leads us down a dark alley if we don't understand its limits. And it leads directly to violence. And
yeah, right. Because it's how to embody absolutes, essentially, in a world where everything is relative. I mean, as in relational, I should say. I don't want to fall into the postmodernist trap there, but everything is contextual and relational. Everything is existing in relation to something else. But words don't. Actually, until we put justice in a sentence, it's just justice, and that's an absolute, right? Like, words are almost always absolute, because they present a concept without nuance. Like, words don't come with adjectives attached to them. Nouns don't come with adjectives attached. They're just nouns. And so then there's an idea of absolute justice just inherent in the word justice. And so on, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That, that's a difficult problem. And I think that maybe the only way around it is to gain greater awareness of the ways in which words can fool us like that. It's not, you know, it's not that we shouldn't have things to aspire towards. We shouldn't, it's not that we shouldn't have ideals, but we have to understand that these ideals are not intended to be somehow, you know, so pure. The whole notion of purity is in a sense an ideal that has gone off the rails. If we believe in this notion of what Derrida talks about, of dichotomies being a kind of yin-yang, where there is necessarily a tension or a difference between things that makes the whole world turn, then everything is contaminated from the get-go, you know, and that's the way it's supposed to be. That's...
Or not, as in the yin-yang symbol is actually... The dot of the black inside the white, or vice versa, is
exactly.
It's not contaminating because it's self-contained, but it's coexisting with it.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Yeah. It's a kind of like a superposition of like the particle wave phenomenon. It's both a particle and a wave at the same time, and yet each is discrete. It's not a blend. It's not a mix. It's not a matter of degrees of particleness and waveness. It's all or nothing, and yet one doesn't exist without the other. It's a and this is true of every instance, you know. Every instance of a particle is also an instance of a wave, and depending on the context in which we examine them, one or the other comes out, but they're both there. And so it's a hard thing for people to wrap their minds around, to think about dichotomies in that way. But I think it's so much more helpful to think of them that way. It's so less, it leads to, I think, an approach to conflict that is so much less violent.
You sort of described the, I don't know about archetypal, but the core conundrum, I think, because how do we think about the limits of thought, really? It's like, how do we think about the fact that we can't actually languify ultimate reality or absolute reality? We can only approach it with humility, I guess. Like, you know, I can't think about this, but I'm going to take a step towards it.
Yeah, it's like we need to learn how to be led by ideas, but we can't be, let's say, overwhelmed by them, which is what you could say happened in the French Revolution. They were overwhelmed by their own ideas, and it's understanding that difference, how to be led by ideas and not be overwhelmed by them is something that Derrida's philosophy hits on that I think is very important. And it's also a difference between two versions of Plato. You know, Plato is often understood as this, you know, guy who constructs these ideal forms, and everything is a copy of the ideal. Mm. Well, the older Plato believed that more in line with the idea that no, these ideals are ideas that something that's out there, sort of like a carrot in front of a donkey. You know, it's like leading you, but you're not ever meant to realize it, because as soon as you realize it, that is death itself. You know, to realize any of these ideals is to stop all motion, is to stop everything. And that's very hard for people to wrap their heads around, because they think, well, if you have an ideal like justice, there must be some way in which it can be perfected.
Hmm. Well, so it's an aspiration, is what it sounds like. And that would speak to the religious idea that we can aspire to union with God, but only God can make it happen.
That would be, yeah, I think one way of putting it in those terms, yeah, because we're on a journey toward God. We're on a journey, but we're not going to realize the end of that journey until the end of our life, until we are, let's say, dead and resurrected. Mm-hmm. And it's when we are in this world and in this life, we are meant to be led by it, but not to be led in the sense of the notion of some purification, which I think traces back to Jesus and how so accepting he was of everybody. I mean, like, he accepted sinners, you know, and everybody. It was, you know, they didn't have to be pure to come to him. Mm. He understood that this whole notion of purity was basically rubbish. We're all on a journey, and we have different journeys, and we need to respect that in every person. So, yeah, I think it's a whole different way of orienting toward words and toward ideals. And I think it's a very interesting one to examine and try to flesh out, which is what Derrida was doing toward the end of his life. Some interesting work, but...
Well, I'm glad we brought it back to Jesus.
Yeah.
Easter's coming up and all. So let me ask one last question then before we wind up. Where do you stand in relation to Catholicism now? You don't have to answer, by the way, because it's actually might be none of my business.
No, it's okay. You can ask me anything.
Okay.
But I have a complicated relationship with Catholicism. I had one of my favorite philosophy professor was a man who was educated at the Institute for Medieval Studies in Toronto, and he was very Catholic and very religious man for many years. But he lost his faith to a certain degree, not entirely, but became very different for him. But he taught me how to appreciate what the Catholic Church has accomplished and what it did over the years. In terms of building culture and building, the edifice of Western culture, and that there are many good things to be said about it. And he also taught me ways to read and appreciate the Bible, along with those two Jesuits I mentioned,
right,
that make me go back to the Bible and look at it with different eyes, especially in the New Testament. I still have a lot of trouble with the Old Testament. But,
right.
So I'm not an institutional Catholic. I don't go to church. I don't even like to be inside a church, because I just feel that there's so much of the wrong kind of message being pervaded through that. But I do believe that, like you seem to believe, that there is value in the book. There's a lot to be gotten out of it if a person can approach it without so much of the past baggage, you know, that is so often laid upon it. Mm. And I'm not an ex-Catholic, but I'm not a Reformed Catholic. I'm a a journeying Catholic?
A liminal Catholic?
Possibly, yeah. Some word in there. I don't reject all of that stuff, you know, wholesale. I try to maintain a, and I try to dip into it again with new eyes.
Well, good answer. I mean, it seems like honesty is the most important thing when it comes to, well, everything, I would say, but particularly this, the divine. So if we really are having trouble making head or tail of it, that's the fact, right? That's where I'm at. I mean, I know there's something. I just don't quite know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that may be actually a good place to be. I think I get worried sometimes about the people who really think they know what it is and go for it. And so,
yeah, exactly.
More power to you.
Well, thanks. To you also.
Thanks.
All right, well, that was a very enjoyable chat. 2 hours and 22 minutes there.
Yeah, it was great talking with you.
Yeah, likewise, and we didn't get to Taxi Driver.
well, that's something maybe we can save for another time.
Yeah, maybe.
But
I guess we thrashed it out in the textual realm anyway. So.
Yeah. Well, good. Keep writing. You definitely have a talent for it, and I think you're doing a lot of good with these books that you're putting out.
Well, thanks. I mean, that would be a great side effect, because I don't seem to have any choice about grinding them out. I've tried to stop, but they just keep on pushing their way out.
Good. All right. Don't block them.
Yeah, no, I won't. No, I've given up trying to give up now. So to hell with purity.
Yeah. All right.
For those of you interested, Prisoner of Infinity, UFOs, Social Engineering, and the Psychology of Fragmentation is now available from Aeon Books. You can find it at their website or at Amazon.whatever. I was thinking just today that if everyone who listened to this podcast bought a copy this week, it would be at the number one spot on Amazon in the whole world. Of course, that's not going to happen, but let's see if something happens, at least. Support this enterprise. I also just did a video, a primer for Prisoner of Infinity, which you can find at my blog.